Greetings, everyone, and welcome to episode number 25 of Real Blend, a podcast that has been playing the same game of Chutes and Ladders for 30 years, but isn't getting a cool new movie about it. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, and I want to say hey to everyone who is watching the live stream of Real Blend on our Facebook page. Be sure to interact with us in the comment section, and producer Gabe, who is behind the glass, will pass us your best comments or questions. By us, I mean my outstanding co-hosts, starting with Mr. Kevin McCarthy, who is the entertainment reporter for Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Kevin, how are you, sir?
Jonathan, how are you, sir?
I'm wonderful. I want everybody on the Facebook feed to take a look at Kevin, who I'm calling Messiah Kevin today, with his Jesus beard and his halo glow behind him. It might be because of the Stanley Cup Championship t-shirt that's on him, and we'll discuss that in a minute. But first, we have to get to Jake Hamilton.
My background is reminding me of the fountain for some reason. I'm not sure why.
Can you do that Hugh Jackman pose? Do that Hugh Jackman pose where his mouth hangs open?
We currently have more viewers at this moment than saw the fountain, though.
Oh, come on. Jake took a week off, so he's coming back refreshed and ready to give us his opinions. Jake Hamilton is with Fox 32 in Chicago. Jake, hello.
Good to see you. Yeah, listened to the podcast last week, and I really, really missed myself.
Is it weird to listen to the podcast when you're not on it?
Yeah. But not for the reasons that you want it to be.
It is. Yeah, I want you to feel like you want to chime in necessarily.
I shouted things out loud if it makes you feel better.
Oh, I wanted to do that thing where you like live tweet the show when you listen to it. We missed the opportunity. So can you skip next week and then maybe we'll do that again?
Done.
If you're watching us on the Facebook channel, as I said, hello. We are also, we have a Twitter page at Real Blend, R-E-E-L-B-L-E-N-D. We have an iTunes account. If you're listening to us, please give us a star rating and leave us a review. We definitely appreciate that. We had a new review. Gabe, if you can give me the new review, I want to read it because it was really nice. And I like that people are giving reviews. So in the meantime, talking points. Kevin, you're not in your normal place and you're in LA. Can you tell us why you're in LA?
Yeah, I'm in LA for a bunch of films. So Jake and I, and we'll get into this later on in the podcast. Last week was kind of a crazy week for me in regards to the show schedule. I know Sean and I were discussing this. I was in Dallas for Tag, and then I was in LA for Incredibles 2, and then Jake and I were in Hawaii for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. We got back Sunday morning, and now I'm back in LA as of yesterday for Sicario 2 tonight, which looks awesome. I'm freaking out because I want to talk to Benicio del Toro. Do you guys remember that moment in Infinity War where Thanos is asking del Toro's character for the stone? It's like a specific reference to Snatch. He's like, "Where is the stone?" I was like so excited about that, so I want to nerd out with
him. I did not catch that reference at all.
Oh yeah,
I did not. That went right over my head.
I just remember Frankie Four Fingers, which was Del Toro's character from Guy Ritchie's Snatch. So tomorrow I'm interviewing Brolin and Del Toro for that, so I'm going to talk to him about that reference. And then later on in the weekend, I have Uncle Drew, which is the Kyrie Irving, Reggie Miller, Chris Weber, and Nate Robinson film. That's why I'm in Los Angeles now.
Also, if you have not seen Kevin's interviews with Josh Brolin, it's worth going back and finding them all. In the most recent one, Brolin mentioned that he wanted to breastfeed Kevin. And adopt him and like take him home. They have a very strange relationship, but it makes for amazing junket videos.
Yeah, I'm gonna bring some. Here's the thing, I wanted to ask you guys this. Like, now I feel more pressure walking into that room tomorrow than I ever have because how do I, like, what do we do next? You know what I mean? Because, like, last time, as you said, he offered to breastfeed me and then have me move in with him, and then he gleeked while he was eating Deadpool trolley candies. So I don't know what the next thing is. I mean, Sicario is such a serious movie. In the first Sicario movie, he just kind of farted the whole interview. So I don't know what he's going to do tomorrow. I have no idea. So we'll see.
I think you just give him control of that. You just give him control of that room.
You had something going with Anne Hathaway, too, where every time you saw her, you kind of escalated.
I did. A long time. It started with an interview that they set up between her and me that made it look like we were out on a date. And it was just this round table and like a candle. It was for the movie
Bride Wars. That was from Bride Wars. I remember that.
And so she made a joke about how us being on a date. And so every interview after that, we escalated it. And at one point when she was paired with Jake Gyllenhaal, we pretended that like I was upset that she was cheating with Jake. At one point when we were in Brazil together, I proposed to her and she was my junket wife. And then finally at a certain point, I just stopped. And in fact, after my interview with her for Les Mis, she like leaned forward to me and she was like, are we not going to do anything? And I was like, no, like, I'm done. Like short of us literally walking down an aisle together, what are we going to do? Like we have to know when to stop.
That's pretty funny. That is kind of exhausting. I would imagine Josh Horowitz over at MTV just runs out of ideas after a while. Like, what
else
can I do? Well,
it helps
we
have an entire MTV production team.
Yeah,
Jake and I, over the years, we've been lucky enough to be able to have enough interviews with actors. Same with you, Sean, where you start to build a relationship in regards to the interview setting. So Jake was talking about the Anne Hathaway element of it. It is kind of cool. It actually helps the interview, specifically if you interview like someone that you admire multiple times, like a Spielberg or something like that. Then they kind of know what kind of things you want to ask, and they kind of, because I've always heard that Spielberg doesn't like specifically talking about the behind the scenes stuff about how movies are made, but I think he somehow knows that I just love it so much, so he ends up answering that question for me anyways every time I ask it. So I think it's just nice to be able to have these multiple encounters with actors, because I think it just kind of creates a good flow for the future interviews.
Before we get to news, since you brought up Spielberg, I do have to mention you guys, as you said, were in Hawaii and you were on the junket for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Not really Spielberg, but seeing a number of things that were Spielberg-esque, the setting of Jurassic Park. And for Jake, too, I mean, it didn't even hit me until you sort of mentioned it. You are such a Lost guy, you know, a fan of the television show, and a lot of that was shot there. So just briefly catch us up. And of course, the picture that just destroyed me, because as the third member of Real Blend, not getting to sleep in the tent with you guys was just heartbreaking. So tell everybody about Fallen Kingdom and about Hawaii. Fallen Kingdom, we'll get into details of that in another podcast as we get closer to release, but you guys got to interview the cast.
Yeah, I think for me, just being a fan of movies, and then like you said, Lost, anyone that knows me knows that Lost was sort of a seminal moment for me. It was where I really started watching serial television and really started appreciating what television could be as an art form. Because it was sort of right before what I think was the breakout of prestige television. And every corner you turn, I mean, Kevin knows, like there is a sign that was like, this scene from Lost was shot here, and I have a pretty encyclopedic knowledge of the show, and it was I'm being laughed at, but it was just really, it was a really cool moment to sort of just kind of pause and be like, you know, like 10, I'm getting like nostalgic as I get older. And so to sort of start being in places that meant a lot to me whenever I was younger, it's a really cool feeling.
Oh, I want to mention the fact that in a text chain, Jake brought up, now that I'm getting older, and I so desperately wanted to reach through the phone and strangle him as someone who is older than Jake is. But Kevin,
it was crazy
like
being there.
Pretty exciting. You've been there before.
Yeah, I've been there before, but it was it's interesting. Going there for a Jurassic Park film was relatively special, especially going with someone like Jake, because obviously Jake and I have very similar lines of how we got to where we are in regards to how movies changed our lives, and just kind of what movies changed our lives. And Jurassic Park was obviously one of those films that I think blew us both away at very young ages. So to kind of be on Kualoa Ranch, where they shot some of the most famous scenes in that film, talking to Jeff Goldblum specifically, was kind of a very surreal thing. But people don't know the story. If you don't know it, originally Spielberg was shooting on Kauai, another island, and then there was a hurricane that came in. Goldblum was telling me that Kathleen Kennedy was very big on getting everybody out and kind of to safety, and then switching to the different island. So if you remember the scene in Jurassic Park when Sam Neill and the kids are not hanging out, but they're running from the dinosaurs, they get behind that log. That's actually shot directly below where we were shooting our interviews with Jeff Goldblum. So it was just very surreal. And then Jake and I were given the opportunity to go back to the hotel the night after our interviews, or sleep in a tent on Kualoa Ranch, which we later found out that we were the first people ever that didn't own the place, apparently, to sleep overnight on this place. And Jake mentioned Lost. They also shot Godzilla there, 51st Dates, Jurassic Park, the newest Jumanji film. So Jake and I had an array of tents to choose from with these gigantic queen beds. It's called glamping. And we had the opportunity to choose our own tent. And there were probably, 10, 15 tents there.
Far fewer press members slept on the ranch than you would imagine. It was right. It was a once in a lifetime opportunity. And most people opted to go back to the hotel.
Right.
That's so lame. Come on.
I know. Well, there were eight of us. I will admit this. I do not like camping, but because it was like an upscaled, like you had a bed and like sheets and showers. It was fun.
Oh, I hate camping. I hate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So not for me.
So Jake and I ended up, we found out somehow that there were tents that had two beds. So we're both in our 30s, grown men, but we're both also at a time where we're interviewing Jeff Goldblum for a Jurassic Park film. Why not sleep together in the same tent? Why not, Jake?
Yeah, and I have to say that Kevin is a very gentle spooner.
I am. You know what's funny about that day? We had a very long day in a good way. Hashtag first world problems. But we had a very, very long day. I mean, we woke up at like 6. We worked on our questions. We went to the interviews. We ziplined. We took a helicopter, all this stuff. Then we went to a dinner afterwards. And we got back. And I'm like, there's no way Jake and I are staying up. It's 9 o'clock. We are going to bed. It was, we were dead. We got back and we were up till 1 in the morning just talking about movies with everybody around a campfire, sandlot style, eating s'mores. And it was like the craziest thing ever. So, and then Jake and I slept together. It was really, really nice. Like we had a tent, two beautiful beds. It was great.
So Sean, how was your weekend?
not nearly as exciting, unfortunately. Although I did put the original Jurassic Park into the DVD player to commemorate its 25th anniversary on Monday. But, I slept in my own bed and cuddled up with the dog, unfortunately.
If people want to see photos, so the way it looked was, it was a tent. You walked in, there were two beds. Jake and I had our own bed, but people came by.
It was like the Four Seasons in a tent.
Right. People came by our tent at 5 in the morning, I guess when we were sleeping, and snapped photos like paparazzi style, TMZ style of us sleeping in our beds. So those photos are available on my Instagram, which is Kevin McCarthy TV, hashtag shameless plug.
And the nudes are in our text chain, so we will share those.
But it's just a blinding white light, which are my lungs.
The best bit of the whole time was Jake's constant jokes about his pale legs. That made me laugh so hard. And like there's the photo of us just like sitting there in the tent. There's like a blinded by the light, like just starts playing in the picture for some reason. And that's what it looks like with Jake's legs.
Or anyone that knows anything about photography, you know that you have to get a white balance before you shoot something. Like my legs are what is used to get a white balance.
Right.
All right. There's a lot of news to get to, so let's jump ahead. We will definitely review Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. We'll probably preview it next week and then get into a greater detail after. I know the boys have some really exciting thoughts about it. I don't get to see it until Tuesday. We're going to, later on in the episode, we're going to finally give Jake a chance to catch up with Hereditary. He went and saw Oceans. Kevin and I have each seen Incredibles 2 and Tag. That's why I'm wearing my shirt. And we're going to do Bullock Blend. We are playing hashtag Bullock Blend to catch up with Sandra Bullock. Our choice has a special sentimental value in terms of the podcast, which we will explain. But before we get to that, ton of news that has happened over the past couple of days. And I'm going all the way far back because there's a lot of stuff that broke like right after we did the podcast last week. But before we get to a trailer that I want to talk about, Wonder Woman 1984 decided to drop a first look photo at what Gal Gadot is going to look like as Wonder Woman in the sequel. And we have a title. And then we realize that Chris Pine is back as Steve Trevor. Love this title. Well, I think he's like a relative. I think he's a relative. There's no way that it could be the actual Steve Trevor. I think it's like Steve Trevor Jr. Like it has to be some type of relative. No way it can be the actual guy. He died. I don't know. He died. I don't know.
Wait, but did he die? How do we know he didn't jump out of that plane? How do we know he didn't jump out of the plane?
Okay, even if he didn't, he still wouldn't look the same in 1984 as he did in World War
I. He doesn't look aged. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Do you think he has the Captain America effect?
Oh, if they better not do that, I would be so disappointed if they come up with some type of like...
But it is Steve Trevor. They said it was Steve Trevor. It's not Steve Trevor Jr. It's Steve Trevor.
They do say Steve Trevor, yes.
Look at Patty Jenkins' tweet. It's not someone who looks like Steve Trevor. It's Steve Trevor.
Are they not filming this by you? Aren't they filming it in D.C.?
It's in my backyard. Yeah, they're shooting it at Landmark Mall and in Georgetown. So...
do you have any access to the set?
Yeah,
whatsoever?
You have to get it. Patty Jenkins loves you. How are you not getting on this set?
Jake knows the frustration of this. He's heard the stories of Dark Knight. You cannot get anywhere. Like, you can shoot from afar, but you cannot get anywhere near it. It's a closed set. Listen, I get it. If I'm Patty Jenkins, like, and I know Patty Jenkins pretty well through the through interviews and through social media, she's busy, man. I almost don't even, like, I've asked to go on set, and I know that, like, Warner's has told me it's a closed set, and I would love to go, but I get it. I mean, if I'm a filmmaker, like, I want to work, you know what I mean? I don't want to be, like, catering to a reporter who needs to come in there and watch them shoot, you know what I mean? So I'm okay with it. I didn't expect to get on there, but I've heard stories of Dark Knight shooting in Chicago and nobody could get on it. People had to shoot from far away, and you know, it's not anything. I'm not taking it personally. I'd like to but I'm not going to.
We have knocked the DCEU a little bit, and we talked about Marvel being very successful. The idea of them fast forwarding Wonder Woman to the 1980s. What do you guys think about that? Yeah, there's Kevin showing Steve Trevor. No, I know that they say,
but
it's Steve Trevor.
It says Steve Trevor. 84. I like it. The title I'm a little questionable on, I guess. I don't know. I don't know. So wait. So let me get this straight. So the first one was 1920. It was World War One. What year was the first movie? 1920. Can't remember. Whatever.
I don't
even World
say
War
it was
One.
Like 1914, like somewhere around there.
Was it? Yeah, you're right. You're right. Like, yeah, it was earlier World War One. So this is going to be clearly what 70 years later. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what's going on in the storyline at this point.
It's a huge
Why they're filming in DC? Yeah, it's huge.
I love the 80s as a time period to set things. I was a big fan. You guys know of The Americans, which just ended 2 weeks ago, which is all 80s. And I love the idea of seeing different characters, how they react to the 80s. And then with Diana Prince, that's just such an interesting character to see how she reacts to certain aspects of life. World War One was so interesting because I feel like we get so many World War II movies that we very rarely get to see World War One. So that was already a cool setting. So I very much look forward to see
is the original
how, yeah, that was great. And I look forward to seeing how she's going to handle what I'm assuming is going to be the Cold War and in the 80s. That's honestly out of everything, that's
that
what intrigues
sense.
Me the most.
Do you
and that would be Steve Trevor.
Called...
That's you're putting another 90 years on Steve Trevor. Like, there's no way it can be
so
the same character.
So he'd be dead because he'd be dead.
Okay, so dumb question. So in regards to when we met Wonder Woman in Batman vs Superman, and then we obviously had her again in Justice League. Is Steve Trevor gone at that point completely out of her life? Because at the beginning of Wonder Woman, isn't it her getting a letter from Batman? Bruce Wayne Chief Trevor. So but that doesn't make any sense because so that I'm assuming is what that's probably 2017, right? When she's looking at that photo, that's present day. Right?
Yeah,
I feel like there's got to be some actual like there's no way that she would drop that photo without it sort of being. I don't know. I feel like we're looking into it too much. I don't think maybe he's not going to be. Maybe just he's not going to be as big of a part or it's a dream
do
sequence
you think,
or
that's what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. Dream sequence because how else do you explain it? Because at the beginning of Wonder Woman, Steve Trevor's clearly dead. Like, not in her life whatsoever. And that's 2017. So,
yeah, right.
And so I don't really know what, if he, does he die again? Did he get out of that plane? Is he cryogenically frozen? I have no clue. I don't know.
Great, if they just keep bringing him back and killing him off.
Yeah. I cannot handle any more frozen Chris's in superhero movies.
I know.
It's too much. Jake, I want you to talk about the... Oh, go ahead, Kevin. I'm sorry.
Did you guys ever see Age of Adeline?
Yes, yeah. I liked Age of Adeline, actually.
Which I absolutely love. I still think that guy should have been young Han Solo. He was amazing.
He was good.
Really good. Do you remember her situation where she couldn't age, obviously, and they placed her in different time frames and you watched her interact with the different years, kind of like Jake was just saying about Wonder Woman? I love that aspect, like watching somebody kind of go through life in different time periods as themselves without aging. So I would be totally interested in seeing how Gal Gadot like does that with the different times. So we'll see.
Jake, fill me in on this George Lucas alternate sequel trilogy idea thing. We have a story on Cinema Blend, but I didn't actually read his quotes. Does he like lay it out in pretty good detail?
So it's interesting. It's you know everyone knows that apparently George Lucas had ideas for what episodes 7, 8, and 9 would have been had he done them, but no one knew what those ideas were. But apparently a book about sci-fi just came out, and there's this little blurb from Lucas, this little quote that's interesting on two parts. The first part is that he reveals that his episodes 7, 8, and 9 would have focused on microbiotics, some very subatomical life that feeds off of the Force and is what gives the galaxy its meaning or some crap like that. But the best part is that he goes on to admit that the fans would probably have hated his idea, much like they hated the Phantom Menace. So
that was funny.
He reveals what I think is, I mean, granted, he didn't reveal what the plot would have been or what, but it would have focused on something called microbiotics and subatomic life.
Okay. Interesting.
So there you go.
Oh, him bringing that stuff up sort of undercuts what they're doing.
But I'm not sure why, because it's published in a book somewhere, and I'm not quite sure, and maybe like, and I'm not sure what the context was, like maybe he was asked about like subatomic life or microbiotics or something. He's like, oh yeah, by the way, the next three Star Wars movies were going to be about that. I'm not sure what the context were for why he brought it up, but it's the first sort of peek at that we've ever been given, and that we probably will ever get. I highly doubt he's ever going to go on record sort of, you know, mapping out, or even if he knows what it
would doesn't serve anything for him to do that at this point. Now we're so far away from it. I want to bring up the First Man trailer because I love Damien Chazelle so much. He did Whiplash and La La Land, which were
both of those were my number ones.
My number ones. Yeah, they were both my number ones the years that they came out. So Sean, I'm on board.
Long distance. Yeah. Podcast woo! High five.
What did you guys think of this trailer? I saw this footage at CinemaCon in Vegas, and I had actually mentioned this to you guys, the ending of this. And the bit that we saw was longer of them coming down the steps of the lunar module and showing the surface of the Earth. But they sort of pulled back a little bit further and showed more of them like sort of walking along the surface. And then if I remember this correctly, they, in the footage I saw, they sort of pan up in their view and you see where the Earth is from where they're standing. And it was this really disorienting, shot. So, so Michelle watched this trailer with me and she was like, yeah, but you already know that what they do, like with the mission. And I was like, yeah, but you know, the Titanic sinks too. Like that's still an exciting movie. So what are your guys' thoughts on this? Are you excited for it, or?
The shot that got me in this movie wasn't even so much that one. It was whenever they were going to walk toward the rocket, and they look up and the lights are shaking, which means that like how sort of not makeshift, but like how sort of raggedy everything was, and how terrifying. And that's what really got me with the trailer, is how terrifying that must have been. And I mean, think about the technology that they didn't have. I mean, I think we're probably using more technology to pull off this podcast than they had to get themselves to the moon. Yeah. And how, like, whenever they're being locked in and one of the guys says, hey, do you have a Swiss Army knife? Like, you're about to put someone on the moon and you need a Swiss Army knife to do something? Right. Like, that's the last thing you hear before you take off. And seeing, like, the lights sort of shaking, like, they didn't even, like, have the lights secured whenever they went up there. That's what struck me. Yes, I know they make it back, but it's the same thing with Apollo 13. Doesn't mean I can't get... like can't appreciate how absolutely unbelievably terrifying that had to be. And as a kid that grew up in Houston, I literally was lived walking distance from Johnson Space Center. Like I have such an appreciation for what they do there. And I just don't think I've truly seen how scary that must have been for those guys.
Yeah. I think the trailer, well, first of all, I think one of the beauties of filmmaking is if a filmmaker is doing his job, he will completely make you forget reality, meaning that you'll be so suspended in disbelief while you're watching a film that you completely forget what happens at the end of the story. And I've had that happen numerous times. I've been in a film where I've genuinely been sitting there watching a film, knowing the ending to a story, but somehow forgetting what's going to happen. So The Post is a great example of that, right? So we already
Wait, I
knew
got one.
Published...
Man on Wire. What?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
Man
on Wire. You know he does the walk. He, right. You know he completes it. But the act of him doing it is enthralling. My palms are sweating now thinking about it.
The Post was another one of those for me, because The Post, I already knew they published the papers, but it was like this sheer intensity living up to the decision that Meryl Streep's character was going to make. Spielberg, that's the magic, man. If you that's kind of what a filmmaker longs to get, is that audience in the palm of his hand, like forgetting what's happening. I think that Damien Chazelle completely has that ability. Whiplash is an absolute masterclass in just intensity, just based around dialogue and music. La La Land was a movie that was made, you know, Whiplash was made out of anger because he couldn't make La La Land. And then eventually La La Land was the next film he did. This trailer didn't do much for me specifically, but I'm not, that doesn't discount at all my excitement for the film. It's my most anticipated movie of the year post Ready Player One. So I have no doubt in my mind that this film is going to be executed in the best way possible from one of the best filmmakers working today. The trailer
70mm IMAX, dude. 70mm IMAX for some shots.
So some of the shots he shot film, which actually, which is, by the way, it's very cool. Patty Jenkins is following in the same line for Wonder Woman 2. Now, we all know Nolan kind of really brought this into, in my mind, really kind of catapulted this type of filmmaking into feature filmmaking, which is kind of was used more for science movies and things you would see at like museums for a long time. And then Dark Knight, Interstellar, Dunkirk. Now Wonder Woman's doing it. Brad Bird did it in Ghost Protocol. But now you're mentioning Damien Chazelle. I can imagine what scenes that are going to be in this format. And seeing that jump to 70mm, which if you live in an area that has a 70mm IMAX projector, definitely if you can go. But yeah, the trailer, nothing specifically really kind of blew me away. The only thing I'm having trouble with is looking past Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong. I haven't yet gotten to a point where my mind is seeing Neil Armstrong. I'm seeing Ryan Gosling in a spacesuit. So it's one of those things where the first time I saw the poster with Ryan's face in the helmet, I thought of what it was like watching like Last Action Hero, where you'd walk into like a Blockbuster and see famous actors on fake movie posters, like Stallone was on Terminator 2.
I see that.
But I will say this. Again, this is completely based on promo footage that we've seen. I have not seen the film. I have literally no diminishing excitement for this movie based on anything I've seen. The trailer just did not blow my mind. That's all. That's all.
Or do you remember that fake poster? Was it in Jane Silent Bob Strike Back when there's a billboard and it's like Ben Affleck and he's in like an astronaut suit and he's like looking off into the distance?
Exactly. That's kind of like, I'm not sure. It's funny when you watch, La La Land, there's a weird thing where you still are knowing you're watching Gosling and Stone, but they're so good in it that it, you know what I mean? Like, it's almost as if there's, when I'm watching Emma Stone perform in that movie, I'm able to fully be in the storyline, but I still know it's her. So I think Gosling as a space, as Neil Armstrong, I'm not ready for that transition in my mind yet. So maybe I will be once
that's an interesting point, is that for a lot of movies that I really love, if you hard pressed me, asked what the name of their character was, I'd have to stop and really think for a long time. Like, I'd kind of know just sitting here thinking that her name is Mia in La La Land, but I'm always just like, Emma Stone. It's Emma Stone.
Yeah. That's a good
point. But it's fascinating to me because
I'm also bad with people's names in real life, much less movie character names.
But there are so many actors, and Ryan Gosling is one of them, that you can, if they play the part right and they're directed right, you can completely forget that it's them. And you watch Drive or things like that, there are ways to look at performances. If there's Tom Hanks can still do it, Denzel can still do it. And I know people didn't really particularly like Roman J. Israel, but that is one of the best performances I saw from an actor last
year. That
was
a great performance.
And and the movie wasn't as good, but oh my God. Like, he disappeared.
I was actually okay with him getting an Oscar nomination.
Me too. I was shocked because there was no one saw the movie. Yeah. But so I'm still not sold on Gosling, but I guarantee you the minute that 70mm projector fires up and that movie hits the screen and Chazelle takes me into his world, I think I'm going to be...
Do we know Denzel. Who's playing Buzz Aldrin?
No.
Oh, I don't know. No. That'd be funny if it was Tim Allen, though.
Kyle Chandler's in the movie, and Kyle Chandler is a national treasure that should be protected at all costs. So
it's very true. I love him.
I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up in my top five. And I'm only saying that because Chazelle has not done me wrong yet, and he's only getting better as a filmmaker. He is just... That guy is legendary already. He's a freaking genius. So I'm all in.
Speaking of freaking geniuses, Jake Hamilton did not get to give us his choice for Hitchcock blend last week. And so we want to play a mini version of a blend game before we get into the full Bullock blend last week. Jake, Kevin went with, you listened, but I forget. Kevin went with Rope for his favorite and Vertigo for his best. I went for North by Northwest as both my favorite and my best. Although I also love Shadow of a Doubt, which is so great with Uncle Charlie. What is your choice for best? Actually, did we get it? Gabe, can we guess? Gabe, do we have time?
Here's what I'm saying. Before you guess, you know, we've been talking
Don't
a lot
give me
about
the move it along.
The
Hold on. Gabe's giving me the move it along already. And
listen,
we're just,
Gabe.
Just starting the segment.
Yeah, Gabe, you're just going to have to sit there and listen to us talk.
And in honor of Sandra Bullock, we're Dennis Hopper, and this podcast is our bus. So just hold on tight, and let's see where it goes. So I think, you know, we've talked a lot about the stipulations in terms of picking the best. We've been very adamant about separating it from favorite, about how it's not necessarily what you think the favorite is. But the more I think about it, I do think that there has to be an element, and I sort of touched on this with David Fincher, there has to be an element of rewatchability.
Yes.
There has to be, like, there even and rewatchability a lot of times has to do with favorite. Usually those two go hand in hand, but I think it needs to be brought into the conversation for me more than I have been, because a lot of the ones that I've picked lately that have been best are not necessarily ones that I'd want to rewatch. And I think that's a little unfair to the ones that people have made that I've wanted to rewatch 10,000 times, which is why I'm going to go with
Wait, we get the guess.
Oh.
Did you say Psycho? You said Psycho. That was my guess anyway. I did. That was
going
to be my guess.
Okay, well then you would have gotten it. And the reason I'm going with Psycho is because it's pinnacle Hitchcock. Literally shot for shot is perfectly thought out and framed. He was daring in ways that filmmakers did not have the guts to be daring in so many parts. It's the first movie, it might be the first movie to show a man in a dress.
It Hot ends with them. Some Like It Hot is all about them in dresses.
Well, but did Some Like It Hot come out before Psycho?
Yeah, I think so. It was the 50s, 54.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Well then take that out. But still, I mean, just the tension of it. The daringness to kill off your leading lady halfway through the film, and the fear that it's generally like a terrifying film. And also I love rewatching as much as I love Vertigo and North by Northwest, and I wouldn't necessarily want to rewatch those before I'd rewatch Psycho. Like, I could sit down and watch Psycho right now. And so I think that's why I ended up giving the edge to Psycho, is because I don't have to excuse any filmmaking elements, because from a filmmaking standpoint, it's Hitchcock. To me, it shows how much of a genius it is. One of my favorite stories is that the MPAA asked him to recut the shower scene. He held on to it for about 3 weeks and went back and said, I made a lot of changes. And they watched it and they're like, it's so much better. So much better. And he didn't touch it at all. I mean, just so many shots. I mean, you turn a shower head on anytime someone takes a shot of a shower head, that's a tip of the cap to Psycho.
I still don't know how he filmed the shower head. I still don't understand.
Oh, it's easy. They built it was a 12-inch diameter water. I read this somewhere. Like, if you looked up at the camera, the water went around the lens, not into the lens. But the way it was shot, it looked like it was just a normal shower head, from what I understand. I could be wrong.
That's crazy.
Again, if any water was hitting that lens, there was always theories that maybe he put a plastic bag over the, but you would have seen the water hitting the lens.
Yeah, so you
I think he shot, from what I'm understanding, I think the camera was really far down, maybe like in the tub itself. And then I think the shower head itself was like a 12-inch diameter circle. I have to look at the shower again, because I don't remember if there's water coming out in the middle of it. But it was so much so that the water would eventually go around the camera lens, not into it, I think.
That's amazing.
I think that's how they did it.
Let's talk rewatch.
That's why I chose Psycho.
That's a great choice. And I can totally see that. I think that might have been the reader's choice. Let's talk about rewatchability with a movie called Hereditary. Either of you guys want to see Hereditary again?
No.
For me, yes, just to have a better grasp on what happened. It's one of the first movies in a while I can remember where I walked out and genuinely didn't have a grasp as to what it was that I saw. And I feel like seeing it a second time.
Let's warn everybody that we are now, because we teased it last week, and this week we're going to dive into a spoiler conversation of Hereditary so that we can try to figure out what the heck we watched. Jake wasn't part of the conversation last week. We focused heavily on Toni Collette and how amazing she is in it. We've
Oscar
asked a few questions. Well, and they're starting the campaign. Like, A24 just put out a video today that's like, keep this woman on your radar because her performance is that good in it.
Agreed.
But I had a couple of questions, and we addressed some of this on Cinema Blend. The part that I don't understand. So now let's try to hash this out. Jake and I were trying to figure out the ending of it in a text chain. The satanic cult needed the oldest son's body, essentially. But did the spirit of the grandma live inside the daughter? or like the daughter was she possessed?
I thought so, because wasn't there a scene where it showed the light going to her and then she gets up on the bed and looks outside the window?
I feel like that's possible.
I don't understand. Is it like if the spirit got into the wrong body and the spirit had to get out of the body through decapitation, which is what I started taking, but the daughter's decapitation was an accident. So was that just an amazing coincidence that because the daughter was accidentally decapitated, that the demon was then able to get out of her body?
I think the daughter was imprinted on early. So I think from what I remember specifically is that Toni Collette talks about keeping the son away from the grandmother on purpose, and then the grandmother kind of latching on to the daughter. But if they needed a male host, I don't know where the grandmother somehow, when she died, left a message saying that this is all going to be working out. Just let the problems happen because it will be better for everybody in the end. So I don't know how the grandmother somehow in her mind was able to figure out, like Jake was saying, the accidental decapitation of the daughter. Or I don't even know if the decapitation of the daughter was even something that needed to happen for the events to flow forward. I think the decapitation of the daughter was just the death that led to the craziness of what was happening with Alex Wolff that kind of got him emotionally into the position to be the host. But I don't know. The decapitation thing was fascinating because Toni Collette's moment of decapitation, specifically in the attic, there was something going on there. So I don't know. I think the grandmother already had instilled something into the granddaughter that was already in motion somehow. But I still don't understand that.
There's something to do with the floating light. And that's why I need to revisit it to keep track of where the floating light goes. Because I think you just hit on something about the decapitations release the floating light, right? And so the light goes from person to person.
But the other decapitations are on purpose. And Charlie's decapitation was by accident.
Well, so when Ann Dowd's character, the woman who is recruiting Toni Collette for the seances.
Who I love, by the way. She's also fantastic.
When she goes to Toni Collette outside of the AA meetings, or the sorrow meetings, not the AA meetings, the sorrow meetings, and says, are you still recovering over the loss of your mother? And she says, no, I actually lost a child. I think that Ann Dowd's character is surprised in that moment. Like, I don't think that she knew about the decapitation, and that sort of like sped up their process. I don't think she knew that the daughter was dead at that point. I think that caught her off guard. So I think what happened was the spirit was inside the daughter and they were keeping it there until they could get to the son. Right.
Right.
Then the daughter gets decapitated surprisingly, and it almost forces the cult's hand because now the spirit is out of her body and has to go someplace. So I think it goes to the husband. Because that's why the husband catches on fire when she throws the book into the thing.
I was wondering why the husband caught, like, that was another reason why I didn't understand why the husband caught on fire.
So listen, so the spirit's in the husband, right?
Okay.
Then he catches on fire, and it goes from the husband to Toni Collette, which is why Toni Collette has to cut her own head off so that it can be released from her.
Like, the demon is hopping from person to person with the ultimate goal of getting to the son.
Yes.
And
what was what was the reason of bringing the grandmother's dead body back? Who Gabriel Byrne makes several comments about, like, what's that smell? Several times throughout the film, he keeps talking about a smell in the house.
Oh, really?
That we eventually learn is the grandmother's body in the attic. Right. What was the point of bringing? And also, I'm assuming so the demon had to have been in the grandmother's body because the grandmother's body was decapitated.
Yes.
Remember he gets the phone call that, like, what do you mean defiled?
Yes.
Someone had to have gotten to the grandmother in the grave, decapitated that body. At that point, the light goes to Charlie, who is accidentally decapitated. Then the light goes. I think the one light that I did not see is when it went to the husband. That's the one.
Right.
That's why I was confused about. So
it might have been. It might have been as the flames went to his body. Like, I think it might, and I don't know for sure. Maybe the flames were the light. I have no. I don't know.
Maybe.
But
I need to see it again.
Yeah.
It's super
fascinating to think about the jump. I think my biggest problem with the film, and you guys are going to make fun of me because remember I had the minuscule issue with the nail in Quiet Place. There were two moments.
That freaking nail, dude.
There were two moments of Alex Wolff's performance that made the film not great for me.
I thought he was good.
Yeah.
He was very good. But he had two scenes that completely pulled me out of the film like the nail. And they're very small. And I'm not trying to be that guy who's being super persnickety about like little details. But no, it's if okay. I am, huh?
It's okay. I'm dying to hear what these are.
If I am completely suspended in disbelief in a scene, something can happen that pulls me out of it that actually genuinely pulled me out so much that I actually said to myself internally, whoa, I'm sitting in a movie theater. Oh, I want to get back into this world. What do I need to do? Like it was like an outer body experience. And it was like the nail in Quiet Place. It pulled me out completely. And then I had to get sucked back in. Because Toni Collette is so great in the film, I was able to. But there's two scenes. One, the moment when they're conjuring Charlie's spirit in the house, when they wake up at 1:30 in the morning.
Yes. Alex Wolff's,
great moment. Amazing scene. Alex Wolff is genuinely freaking out. And then there's this terrible, like, over-the-top cry that he does into Gabrielle Byrne's shoulder that was so bad. It sounded like somebody was, like, trying out for a play.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
It was horrendous. Like, it was like,
you're going to ruin this for me.
I agree with you on that because that actually stood out to me because in my head I thought like that's a weird thing for like an 18-year-old man to do. Like, and I'm not saying that like older men can't cry, but like he's crying like a 6-year-old kid into
his father's
arms.
When have you ever been in a séance and stood your ground?
Last Thursday. Joke's on you now.
There's nothing wrong with the over-the-top. Like, listen, I get why he cried. I get the mentality
I'm with you on that, Kevin.
But that messed me up. So that happens, and I'm like, and then I literally go, oh, I'm in a movie theater. I need to go back into this movie now in my mind. And then the second one was, oh, my God, I hated this. The leap from the attic out the window to the ground. Like, it just felt like the actor was doing it for the first time. And I get the character decision. I would have done the same thing. But the way it was edited to the moment of the jump felt like it was just like, all right, Alex, we need you to try the shot real quick. And it was like the first time he ever did it. And then he just like jumped out. So those were two like very – and then the third thing was the finale in the treehouse.
Yeah.
I just didn't buy his body language in that moment. Like the – and then the explanation of what was happening – him being the male host. I don't know. I just, the look on his face, it didn't sell it for me. So I was distracted by, but then everything else he did in the movie, his reaction when the decapitation happened, the reaction of getting home, the reaction of being in the bed as Tony's screaming when she finds the dead body, phenomenal. So like everything he did in the movie, I genuinely liked, except for these moments, which genuinely pulled me out. And then the idea of the ending not giving me enough to chew on as I left. These are my problems with the movie. And listen, I have no problem with a film being open-ended. Make me think. Make me question things. No problem. Like, one of the best open-ended endings ever is the end of Whiplash, right? Like, it just ends. But there's enough to chew on to figure out what's going to happen. I remember Miles Teller saying that he ends up dying alone years later, which is very depressing. But the concept of something to chew on as an audience member at the end of a film, there was not enough given to me that I could go home and go, okay, what happened? So I almost don't care like what happened because I don't feel like there's enough for me to understand. That's all.
There are two things in that movie that to me were scarier than any of the cult stuff. And I think that for a first time director, like this is an amazing accomplishment a first time writer director. And I really do think for a lot of these questions that we're asking that a second view is going to answer a lot of them. But I thought he did something that horror movies don't do quite as well, which is when you have that sensation that you're looking into a dark corner of your room and your room feels really safe and you think you see somebody standing there and it just really catches you off guard. Like that's really hard to capture on film, right?
I thought that's a good point. The
few instances that Hereditary tried that, I think there's two that I can think of.
And the movie's very well creepy. Done. Like on every shot, the initial shots into the dollhouses, the POV shots, the way the camera worked as you turned with the eyes of Will, of his character as he's looking around the room. The shot you're referring to, Sean, all amazingly executed. I actually like the film a lot. I give it a 4 out of 5.
Well, here's the one thing that I think is even scarier than that. This was the feeling that got me the most with Hereditary, where I was like, this movie has messed me up. When that kid is driving and his sister dies, right? Yeah. How terrifying is the feeling of, I've just made a lethal mistake, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh,
and,
yeah.
He's and paralyzed. Why can't I turn back? We don't have the power to turn back the clock. And you have all of these repercussions that you're about to face for something that he legitimately didn't do wrong. Right? Like, it's not really his fault.
She put her head out the window.
Amazing writing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That is incredible. That, to me, that sense of dread is scarier than any type of satanic cult who wants to possess your body. Like, that freaks me out.
And also, that limbo moment before, because sometimes even dealing with the repercussions can begin that grief process. But like that moment in between when it happened and when he has to deal with the consequences is just this horrible, where you have to stop and think. Yeah, that. I mean, how many times have we thought in our lives, like, if I could just turn back like 10 minutes and make a different decision?
Yeah.
And it seems so easy, but it's just so unbelievably impossible.
I also find it really fascinating that when he gets home, there is a good 15, 20 minute period of the film where it's not ever talked about. Like, it's they get home, she finds the body, they have the funeral scene, but there's never the moment where he tells his parents what happened. We later find out through non-expositionary dialogue that he obviously told his mom what happened. I thought that was a very interesting filmmaking choice. It was also a thing that kind of pulled me out for a little bit because I kept looking over at Lauren going, are they not going to discuss this? But then again, that's because we are so accustomed to films over-explaining things to us constantly that when a director makes a different choice, like a Dunkirk or something like that, where they're going to just allow things to take place and then you have to just understand that conversations probably happened off screen. We don't need to be overly told what's happening. I want more movies to be like that. I want more less explanation and just let me figure things out. But you still need something to chew on, which is why the ending kind of upset me a little bit. But
super early to even predict this, but what are the chances Hereditary makes your top 10?
Zero.
I think there's a chance. Yeah.
No, it's not even in my top 10 now. No,
I could see the film. I could see that movie being becoming better. Like, because I'm definitely going to rewatch it, and I could see that movie being better for me upon rewatch. I just want to have a little bit of a better grasp of what it is that I saw, and even honestly, just through this discussion, makes me like it a little bit more. I don't think it's scary. I don't.
Which
I'm not going to knock it as. It's but you know, like every independent horror film that comes out, it claims that it's the greatest horror, like scariest film of all time. And I think that's why they get such low cinema scores, is that they try to convince the average movie going public that it's The Conjuring, and it's not. Like, you can go into a horror movie and it can be an incredible film without it being scary.
Right.
But people think that whenever I say that a horror film isn't scary, that I'm knocking it. I'm not. But like I liked it. But I got a lot of flack online for saying out loud that I didn't find it to be scary. And I don't think it's a scary movie. And it's just like,
Are you kidding me? That movie is freaky, man.
I did not think it was scary. Not in the least bit.
Interesting.
It's scary.
I thought it was a great
much.
Horror film. And it almost made my top 10 list, but it was not scary to me in the least bit.
Interesting.
But that's not me knocking it. It just means that it didn't get me going.
I'm not
talking about jump skill.
I didn't realize that you hated it.
Oh, sweet Christ. You've become the internet.
We are running out of time and cannot do Incredibles 2 and Tag, unfortunately. Let's do really quick with Kevin. Do you recommend both those movies?
I do. Incredibles 2 specifically. Amazing. It's genuinely just well-paced, incredible action. I haven't seen the first one in about 12 years, so people keep asking me, is it better than the first one? I love the first one. I saw it in theaters, but it's been a while, so I need to watch it again, but I genuinely find this film to be just a perfect sequel. It's like everything I wanted from the Incredibles sequel. I know Sean saw it. The action's amazing. I loved Bob Odenkirk. What a great performance from him voice-wise. Catherine Keener's fantastic. Everybody. And Brad Bird, I had a great discussion with him about the filmmaking behind this movie, because I know this is a loaded question to ask a director, but how do you direct animation in the sense of, if you look at the movie credits at the end, well, but if you look at the end, it says director of photography, camera, and then director of photography, lighting. But there's no camera and there's no lighting, literally speaking. But they have this world. So Brad Bird was telling me that he got down to a point where he directed the film as if he directed live action. He was having them change shutter speeds digitally in shots, which is so cool. Because you remember the opening of Saving Private Ryan, Kaminsky adjusted the shutter speed to make this shot look the way it did. I mean, the storming of the beach. And it looked that way because of the way they shot it. So the fact that Brad Bird is thinking to himself, I want a different shutter speed in this animation shot, is really cool to me. On top of that...
Well, do you know something that they do at Pixar? Though I learned this when I went out there. They have an archive at Pixar now, and they do so much statue molds. They create statue molds of everything that they do to see how lighting and shading affect shots.
In Chicago, there is a Pixar exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry right now that takes Pixar films and then breaks them apart through a science and math standpoint. And one of the things, to your point, that they did, that they built this entire field of grass and a tree, and it's there at the museum, that's about the size of my condo. And they put little cameras in there that you can move around and bring down into the grass to, like, look up at the grass so that you see the perspective of, like, what an ant would see.
Yeah.
So they build these massive worlds and then put little cameras all over the place so that you can replicate the lighting and perspective. Because we'll never know what – I mean, we're not Rick Moranis. We'll never know what it's like to be shrunk and look up and look – like, so I just thought that was really cool. It's called The Science Behind Pixar. It's at the Museum of Science and Industry here in Chicago right now. It's for kids that – I think it's going to be touring around to a lot of different cities. If you have kids that question why they take math and science classes, this is a brilliant exhibit because it says, hey, if you pay attention to math and science, you could win an Oscar one day.
Well, that's why it blew my mind when I did the Ant-Man junket, because the extent that filmmakers go to, Jake can say whatever he wants, Ant-Man's amazing, but the extent these filmmakers go to get these shots. Like, so for example, Ant-Man has an entire macro unit. There's a literal unit that goes out and shoots every perspective of Ant-Man. So they take these little cameras, and there's a scene in the first Ant-Man where Ant-Man goes through a vacuum cleaner. They literally took cameras and shoved them into a vacuum cleaner and got that perspective. So when Paul Rudd is in that tub as the water's about to come on, when Michael Peña is, I think, about to shower or whatever, they put cameras down there.
The tub that's above a dance club?
For some reason, you know, you can hate on Ant-Man all you want, and I know I bet you $1 million.
Tell me I'm wrong. It's an apartment that's above a dance club that's full of people in the middle of the day.
In the middle of the day,
you guys, you know what? They're criminals and they're hiding out, man. Come on, you have to get past that.
That's not the part that I can't get past.
Don't it's even get me.
They live above a dance club that's full of people on a Tuesday afternoon.
Wait, but don't even get me started on why Han Solo gets his name from a guy that says, oh, you're by yourself? Solo!
That's plausible. You know what's not plausible? A dance club full of people on a Tuesday afternoon.
I can't stand the Solo getting his name.
San Francisco is a vibrant place.
Apparently.
Let's jump to Ocean's 8 really fast. We can do Incredibles 2 in depth next week. We can do Tag in depth next week too. I want to just talk Ocean's 8 really fast. Jake, you saw it. Where would you rank it of the three existing and then this one?
The more I think about it, honestly, the less I like it. Walking out, I would have maybe put it third ahead of 12. I really love 11. I really love 13.
12 is great.
But the more and more I think about it, I think I might put it behind 12. It was fine. It was fine. I didn't particularly have a ton of fun watching. It just sort of felt like, it didn't feel organic to me. It sort of felt like these new actors sort of doing things that had already been done before. Okay. I love the actresses involved. I think that they have the capacity to, I mean, everyone, you know, I know we're getting these female-led remakes, and I'm all for the success of female-led films, and I think that's obviously the representation is incredibly important, but I also think that all of these actresses are strong enough to lead a film that doesn't have to piggyback on the success of others. I mean, rather than see an all-female version of Ghostbusters or see an all-female version of Oceans, why can't we see all these actresses in a new original piece of work that makes men want to look at it and go, oh, man, that would have been cool to do that. Like, I just want to see new original pieces of work.
I will come back to Oceans in a second, but that brings up Upgrade, which I saw last night, which
ooh, I want to see. I've heard nothing but amazing things.
Oh, dude, it's so great. It's so great. And what the thing is about it is that it reminds me of these films. RoboCop, The First Terminator, The Matrix. It's in line with those movies. It feels like those movies, but it's its own thing. And watching
Sean,
it, I was like,
"Did you watch that interview I sent you about how they?"
No,
did
I didn't
stuff?
Get a chance to yet. It's
fascinating. STEM was happening on set. Like that was all. Like the guy was talking to him on set, and then those shots of like when he's like rising up, they put those are iPhone shots, man. Like they put iPhones on a board and like raised him up in those fight scenes. It's crazy.
It's so great. You guys have to see it. You got to check it out. And then we'll talk in depth and we'll try to get Lee Whannell. Is it Lee Whannell? Is that, how do you pronounce his last name, Kevin?
I think it's Whannell. I think so.
Whannell. He's really nice and I want to get him on the podcast. Back to Oceans for a second. This is what bothered me the most. We're going to talk spoilers. We're into spoiler conversation for Oceans. If you guys are tagging along, if you're watching on the Facebook feed, be careful. The heist to me is so bad. The heist doesn't stand up to any scrutiny at all. And I don't need these heists to be airtight. But I need them to make a little bit of sense. And this one was so disappointing.
There are certain aspects of the heist that required random strangers to just go along with things. Case in point, Sarah Paulson finding the necklace in the water and sort of being like, hey, here it is. And then the people just be like, hey, cool. Thanks for finding it and taking it. Like, I feel like you're talking about security that shut down an entire Met Gala. They're just not going to question the person that found it in the water. They're just going to take it and be like, all right. I mean, it required so many like, that's fine. Like you sort of have, I get there is an element of like for all of these heists, you know, we're talking, Ocean's 13, they reenact an earthquake in the middle of Las Vegas. You have to lift your disbelief at some point, but there is a little bit to me beyond plausibility with 8.
Let's talk about how Anne Hathaway gets Helena Bonham Carter to actually to decide to hire her. They like set up that fake photograph of a lunch and they put it in page 6. Like in what era is Anne Hathaway's character reading the New York Post in page 6 and be like, what? She's with that girl? Right. Get me that designer. I need her instead.
It requires so a lot bad. Of like random threads that have to happen.
Right. Right. And I just think the other movies did, not that they went above and beyond to lay out all their facts, but they tried harder. I thought they just tried harder to make sense.
Right. Every time I watched one of the heist in 11, 12, 13, there was a part of me that thought maybe they're not going to get away with it. Maybe, especially the first one. The first one makes you think that they're failing and it turns out to all be part of the plan. But 12 and 13, I watched both of those and thought maybe this is the one where they don't pull it off. And then they end up pulling it off. With 8, I never once questioned whether or not it was going to be okay. Like there was no inherent danger or drama because I just thought like even when it looked like things would start to go not according to plan, I thought, oh, this is probably all part of the plan.
And yet it had the biggest opening of the franchise.
Not adjusted for inflation.
Yeah, inflation, yeah. Well, listen, I liked Ocean's 8 actually a lot. I think Gary Ross is a very good filmmaker. I loved his first Hunger Games movie. I think that, to me, the best part of the Ocean's movies is the heists within the heist, the things that surprise me. And it surprised me. I the thing that happened outside or inside the heist, that got me, that was kind of cool. I thought James Corden was great. I mean, the cast is very good. Helena Bonham Carter and Anne Hathaway are, in my opinion, steal the movie. They're so great in the film. I didn't find it the heist as bad as you guys are saying. I thought it was fine. I thought it was interesting. I actually thought it was kind of clever how they got the necklace off of her neck with the vomiting element of it. I thought that was kind of cool. I thought that was well done. I mean, I was engaged. I thought it was entertaining. Performance-wise, it was really solid. I wouldn't call it amazing by any means. I think it's better than Ocean's 13 for sure. I'm a 12 guy.
Why don't you like 13?
I don't remember loving 13. I'm weird.
I think Pacino is so good in 13.
I'm not saying 13's not that is bad. I've always been a 12 guy. And I know people make fun of me for that, but I love Ocean's
Soderbergh. 12. Soderbergh says 12 is the best.
12 is the best one. I love the Julia Roberts bit is so good. It's so clever.
That's so,
it's so funny.
I love that.
I think 12 is so pretentious and aware of itself. I mean, sort of how you often describe Thor Ragnarok is how I describe specifically Thor Ragnarok. I think Ocean's 12 thinks it's way funnier than it is, and it just feels like, to me, it feels more like a celebrity exclusive club that you're lucky enough that we let you get to peek into and look at.
Right? Isn't it though?
I can see that.
No, but something like 11 to 13 feels fun. Like I'm right there with them. To me, 12 feels like I'm watching from a distance. And maybe part of that is sort of the idea that we know that Clooney lives a couple of blocks away from where they're shooting. Like, it feels like this vacation that they were all on, that they're like, well, why the hell don't we just film it for tax purposes and make a movie out of it? Like, it just feels like a vacation that, like, let our fans watch us on vacation.
I can see that. All right, so I guess none of us are going to choose Ocean's 8 for Bullock Blend. We are going to play hashtag Bullock Blend, where we debate the best Sandra Bullock performance, not necessarily her best film, and not her Oscar-winning film, unless someone chose The Blind Side. We chose her best
choose The Blind Side
performance. Gabe, I think us.
We didn't go with Annette?
Annette who?
The net
was a an internet film she made in the 90s. I still have my ticket for that, actually.
Gabe, we all picked the same movie, is that right? We all picked Gravity, which is when you look over her body of work,
makes sense.
I don't think that Gravity is the movie that I would define as a Sandra Bullock movie. In fact, if I was defining a Sandra Bullock movie, I don't want to pigeonhole her and say a romantic comedy, but it's probably something more along the lines of Miss Congeniality. But Gravity is, it's her Castaway, right? Like when we did Tom Hanks and we argued Castaway, she's the only one in the scene on
Hanks one.
Yeah. And she's, you know, she's the one, she's the primary focus. She's the one who has to do all the heavy lifting. She is in a astronaut suit for a large part of it and has to act with her face and her voice. Like it's all of these, whenever you strip away all the tools of a performer and then challenge them to still be captivating, so many of them can't do that. And I just think that Gravity is amazing. Why did you guys choose it?
Yeah, for all the reasons that you said. And also there's a certain relatability to her. You know, whenever I watch films about astronauts, for me, there's always a bit of a distance, no pun intended, but because, like, the astronauts are just so much... astronauts are so much inherently smarter than I'll ever be, and there's a certain comprehension that I understand that astronaut characters have that I sort of just go along with a lot of words they say because I'm like, yeah, that sounds astronomical. That sounds good. But she, correct me if I'm wrong, her character was, like brought in... She wasn't a trained astronaut. She was brought in because of her knowledge of something, right? They needed her knowledge of something. And then so there's a relatability, and she juggles so many things. I mean, from, an action standpoint, there are like these beautiful action sequences that she handles fantastically. And also she's dealing with the loss of her daughter. So there's this emotional weight to it. And she has a great rat-a-tat-tat with Clooney, which I was kind of hoping that we would have seen in Ocean's 8. I feel like we were robbed of that. No pun intended. she just juggles and spins so many plates, and you're right. It is her Castaway in every sense of the word. And really, to me, that's the movie she should have won the Oscar for, not The Blind Side, a movie that I'm not a massive fan of.
Yeah, listen, Gravity, we all saw together. Jake and I specifically.
Yeah, we did.
Wait, Sean and I. Sean saw it there too, and then we all discussed it. At TIFF, but. Mm-hmm. Listen, Gravity to me was a defining film. One of the biggest problems I have with people's reactions to that movie were people who criticized it for not having anything more than just being like a space movie or people trying to survive. I thought there was an emotional depth there that was unbelievably well done. But because of the minimal dialogue, I think a lot of people were upset with how they didn't feel for it. And I completely felt the opposite. I felt every aspect of what she was going through. I found myself physically moving in my chair, trying to stretch myself to help her, which was crazy, considering you're sitting in a movie theater. But when you're in that 3D environment that Alfonso Cuarón created with that masterful score and then the sound effects, you have to understand that none of that was done in space, clearly. And that's the crazy part about it, is the way they perform these moments, it feels like they are. And to me, that's the masterful element where a director and a cinematographer and an actor have a relationship unlike anything you could ever imagine. Because they all have to believe in themselves. They all have to believe in the moment. They all have to believe in what they're doing. And it has to feel real, because we feel that sense of realness as well.
I've tried to watch that movie on DVD, and it doesn't hold up.
Oh, I disagree. I think it holds up.
Gravity?
Beautifully.
Yeah, I didn't have the same
impact. Is it that it doesn't hold up, or it just doesn't compare to the cinematic experience? Because I still think it's a great movie.
Yeah.
I think for, you know, if you compare it to the experience you had in theaters, I mean, that's just, that's not fair, because you'll never have that again.
Yeah,
The experience in theaters of that movie, listen, I mean, yeah, and when you drop Dunkirk into a Blu-ray player, it's not as, it doesn't have that 70mm experience, but I still appreciate the storytelling. It's just a reminder that the cinematic experience is the ultimate, and that people should go to that if they can for their first viewings. But Gravity was, it was a game changer in the sense of what it did for filmmaking and the visual effects and the opening, the continuous opening shot, I think at 17 minutes, is just...
Oh.
Unbelievably well done. I mean, Alfonso Cuarón is genuinely one of those guys who just, he stitches shots very, very well. There's a shot in the new Jurassic World that Bayona does. Talk about stitching. Like the stitching that he utilizes, I won't give anything away, but it's in my interview, which is on YouTube. He speaks about it pretty detail-wise, but it's in the trailer. You see Chris swimming in the water as Bryce and Justice are in the gyrosphere as it's going under the water. It's all one shot for you as an audience member, but it's stitched together. But the way he stitches it was with the water level rising. As the water kind of goes up to the gyrosphere, the camera is... It's very cool how they pulled it off. Anyways,
that's
back
cool.
To Alfonso Cuarón.
I love Bayona.
He's amazing. But Alfonso Cuarón, I mean, probably one of the greatest... stitched shots in the history of filmmaking is Children of Men, as Clive is carrying the baby. But that, on top of that, though, the real one shot in that movie is the motorcycle sequence. The spitting of the ping pong ball, which is actually, that ball is CGI. And those guys, and they had a camera rig that the actors had to duck under as it went by them. So think about, you think about this for a second. Like you're in a car sequence. You have four or five people in a car. You have a camera rig that Chivo put above the car that's getting a one shot as this horrific action sequence is taking place. Meanwhile, the actors, as the camera comes by them, choreography-wise, had to go like this as it went above their head and then around to the next person. And then the ball is CGI. And then obviously there's blood. I mean, I don't know how the hell he pulled that off. It is
insane.
So then you take that and then you add it to a budget like Gravity, and then you do a 17-minute opening shot in space. That's where that comes from. I mean, that guy is just a storyteller immersing
and then
you
have,
in a moment. It's unbelievable.
But then you have a performance like Sandra Bullock, who has to humanize it all, who has
right.
to sort of give you someone to relate to.
That's where
what
it
I
all
think.
Comes down to filmmaking. You have a That's where the director, the cinematographer, the animators, and the actors all work in this beautiful in-sync pattern. And it just works. That's it. That's filmmaking.
I think our users who played along at home all came up with Gravity too. I think we pretty much had mostly Gravity. Did we get a Miss Congeniality every once in a while? Gabe has something. Oh, wait. Gabe does have an audience pick in here.
Her two best favorite-wise are Speed and Demolition Man.
I love Speed. I love Speed.
Yeah, but I don't know if I love her performance in Speed. Speed
she's
is just
so
movie.
Good at Speed. Oh my, her
she's
and Keanu Reeves. She's
fine. She's
good.
Think of how clever Speed was. What a clever idea for a movie. It was such a
great
idea. And it was done practically.
We need a Jan de Bont nowadays. We don't have a Jan de Bont. Well, actually, again I'm going to point everybody to Upgrade. Upgrade is a movie made in the tone of Speed.
Why are you guys all disrespecting Demolition Man? What are you guys doing?
Oh, not. No, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. Just over reliance on its Taco Bell marketing placement.
Yes. Yeah,
next, it's a film.
Next week's homework. And I don't really have a reason for choosing this, but we're going to do hashtag Zemeckis blend.
Ooh. I already know what Sean's is. It's Forrest Gump. I already know the answer to that one. I already know it's going to
No, oh Kevin, the best. You have to choose the best. So I think Zemeckis will fit in with our conversation about Incredibles 2 and probably Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom.
Yeah.
And we'll be feeding into Ant-Man, which the guys will potentially be seeing at the end of next week. So we'll reunite next week for a riveting episode of Real Blend. Jake, where can everybody find you?
At Jake's Takes or in the dance club below Ant-Man's bathtub.
Kevin, where can we find you?
You can actually find me in the back behind the guy who gives Solo his last name. During the scene,
there'll be plenty of room because God knows no one will be in the theater.
When he gives Solo his name, I actually look up at him and go, "That was great. That was a great line. Really cool, man." Right.
I'm at Sean _ O'Connell. I want to play catch up. Corey Stoll, the villain from Ant-Man, is playing Buzz Aldrin in First Man.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Yeah, that's really good casting. That is great casting, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to interview Buzz Aldrin last year, and it was genuinely like one of the craziest. And I know the three of us get to interview some truly amazing people, but there's something about shaking the hand of a man who's been on the moon.
That's crazy.
Sort of like kind of not like lowers the other interviews you've done because it's not my favorite interview of all time or anything, but it just sort of makes the other interviews you go just like, oh, like my God, like what have
Jake,
I done with my life?
Jake, yeah. I had that exact moment. I know we have to go. Real quick, I was in the White House for President Obama's last Presidential Medal of Freedom. And Spielberg was being honored, Barbara Streisand, James Taylor. And I'm in this room, 50 feet away from President Obama as he's putting these medals over people's heads. And I'm having this like freak out moment because it's Spielberg, right? So I hear him bring up a woman named Katherine Johnson, and in my mind, I hear everything she's done, and I'm like, oh, that sounds cool, and then I go back to Spielberg, and I'm like, ah, Spielberg, and then I'm like freaking out. I jump across the room. I don't know how I didn't get shot by Secret Service, and I got an interview by Spielberg and Barbara Streisand. Then I leave the room, and then the trailer comes out, then I see Hidden Figures about 6, 7, or 8 months, whatever it was later. And then I realized how much of an idiot I was for not, one, meeting Katherine Johnson, and then, two, just interviewing her. Because I was so, now again, inherently, you see Spielberg, you're going to freak out. I don't fault myself for it. But I wish I had known who she was, and then I wish I would have shaken her hand and said thank you. So I totally understand what you mean by that. It's like one of those weird things. So.
Thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in to the episode number 25. As an anniversary episode, episode number 25.
Yeah, a milestone.
Our baby's growing up. A milestone episode. We are on iTunes, and I want to mention the fact that we're on iTunes, and you guys can leave us reviews, and I do want to say
what's this review that you keep talking about?
This is a 5-star review from
Is it written by Jan Hamilton?
No, because since she would have panned us, she would have said, last week's episode was the best, with just Kevin and Sean. I Love Lunacy writes, great movie podcast. This is real. I'm going to start reading these reviews for people. So if you want to get read on the podcast, we will happily shout you out. I Love Lunacy says, great conversational movie podcast. Great mix, news, reviews, and best of conversations with some great film journalists. So
also Jake.
And Jake. So tune in next week. We will talk about Incredibles 2. We will talk about Tag. There's a controversial joke in Tag that Kevin and I want to talk about.
That joke.
We're going to talk about... I know. We'll get into it. We'll get into Jurassic
Gabe,
World.
You don't wrap us. We wrap you, Gabe.
And we'll be back next week. Thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next
Solo.
Week.
Kirk.
Solo.
Dunkirk.
It's a legitimate reason why he has his last name.